Hello and welcome to You Really Shouldn't Have, with me, James Warwick. The podcast where each week I sit down with a different guest to discuss their career and the worst gift they've ever been given. Joining me this week is music industry executive, Edgell Groves. He stops by to discuss all things music, and in a slight change to usual proceedings, he lets me in on the worst gift he has ever given someone else. Well, Edgell, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming by.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
In terms of music, I know you started off as a performer. So was that something that interested you from a young age?
It was. So my dad is in the music industry, but that wasn't the reason I got into it. I kind of rebelled against it. I was really into sports most of my early life. So I played baseball and football and basketball. Very much an athletic person. And then sometime, I don't know, around 10, 11 years old, I got the bug. And I asked my parents to get me a drum set for Christmas. And once I played the drums, I was like, oh, okay, now I get it. And then when my dad would leave the house, sometimes I would sneak into his bedroom and play his guitar. And I taught myself how to play guitar without my dad knowing. And then I think one day he came home a couple of years later and he thought I was listening to an album in my room, and he opened the door and it was actually me. And he's like, wait, you play guitar? So yeah, it was one of those, like, I didn't want to follow in my dad's footsteps per se. Not that I had anything against it. I just wanted to have my own path, but he never taught me how to play guitar. He never forced me to go that direction. He allowed me to do what I wanted, but it just found me. I guess it's somewhere in my genes. I just wanted to do it. And then, yeah, that led to me being in a lot of bands in high school. And then, around the college years, I started playing in some serious bands, and playing some real shows. And then around 2003, 2004, I started a band that I would end up being in for, just under a decade, called Sun Domingo. And so that's really where the music career started. I'd say around 20 years old is where that really took off.
And then in terms of the process of moving from being on stage to being more behind the scenes, if you like, what was that process?
Yeah, well, I always thought I was going to be a performer my whole life. Uh-huh. I never thought I would transition to the business side. I love being on stage. I love talking to fans. I love traveling. So we were doing, in the early years of the band, we were doing 200 to 250 shows a year.
Wow.
For the first, I'd say 6-7 years. I mean, that was nonstop. And so, you know, you play one night and you play a 3-4 hour set, you get back in the van or the bus, and you go to the next city and you do it all over again. And I had no personal life. It was almost impossible to keep a girlfriend. I think I missed all of my friends, you know, their first child being born and their weddings and all that stuff, birthday parties, forget it. Nobody ever invited me to anything after a while. But I realized after a few years of doing that, that there was a cap on that. I was only going to be able to do that for so long, only make so much money unless we got lucky, unless we had a big hit or somehow built a ravenous fan base. And don't get me wrong, we were doing really well, but it wasn't tenable. It wasn't one of those things where I could see myself in my 30s, 40s, 50s still doing it and still enjoying it. I was burned out. So around 2011, 2012, I transitioned into starting my own record label and management company with a business partner, friend of mine, who lived in Europe, in the Netherlands, actually. And I ended up packing up everything and leaving the United States, and I moved to the Netherlands and started this record label with him. And that was sort of the beginning of that journey. And once I got a taste of that, of like, oh, you can represent artists and you can still be involved in music, but you don't have to go kill yourself on the road. I was super interested in doing that. And the company ended up being like based around progressive rock music. So it wasn't a particularly popular style of music, but we signed a lot of the larger acts. And my partner at the time was already sort of, you know, knee deep in that scene. So things took off pretty quickly. We had like 15 or 20 artists on the roster. And fast forward a couple of years later, you know, I ended up taking a position with a company that was under the Sony Music umbrella. And because of my experience on the A&R management, being in a band, I kind of knew everybody in that scene. And so when they made the offer, I thought, you know, I think I've had enough time here in Amsterdam and the Netherlands, you know, let's do something new. And so I relocated to LA in 2013, 2014 and started my life out here. And then, so I've been here ever since. And then that began the whole nother chapter.
It leads me on nicely to my next question, because I wanted to talk a bit about the term getting signed is often sort of bandied about quite often, and I'm sure there's a preconception of what people think getting signed by a label is, the reality of it being quite different. So when an artist gets signed, exactly what does that mean in the early stages, and what does that process look like on both sides of the table for the artist and for the label?
Good question. I mean, when I got signed, it was a different music industry. We were still selling CDs at the merch table and out of the back of our van, and that's how we afforded our ramen noodles, right? So, and when we got our deal, it was through a Warner Music subsidiary out of New York City. And so we were excited to get our first deal, and we flew up to New York and we signed the paperwork and went out for drinks with the head of A&R, and it was a whole thing. And then you quickly realize after you sign a deal, like, oh, nothing's really changed. You still have to do all the work. We still had to go play 200 shows that year. We still had to, you know, go record all the music ourselves. We still had to do all the marketing. The only difference was they happened to have a few resources. They were willing to pick up the phone on your behalf, but really nothing changed. Our lives didn't become enriched in any real way. You know, and so I think that was a hard lesson, because for years we chased getting that deal. And then once we got it, we're like, now what? Okay. Now we got the deal. Now what do we do? And how do you become a priority to these people? And the reality was the music industry then was in shambles. So this was around 2008. It was starting to fall off. You know, recorded music was hardly worth anything. It was on the decline. Music piracy was up, and touring was in a bad place because the US economy tanked. You know, the real estate bubble burst, and things were just in a bad place. So we were having a hard time just getting people to buy tickets to our shows, much less buy our music. And the label didn't want to spend money. So it couldn't have been worse timing in terms of signing a record deal. Now, if you talk about what a deal looks like, the whole landscape has changed. Digital streaming owns the space. You know, whether you're Spotify or Apple Music or SoundCloud or YouTube and now TikTok, they all have something different to offer. There's a different way to reach an audience within each of those. And labels now, instead of looking at music and looking at the content, they're looking at the numbers. Mm. They're looking at, should we sign this artist based on their numbers? And, oh, if their numbers are good, that must mean people like it. So let's put money and resources into that. And so in a lot of ways, the streaming industry saved the recorded music industry, because music wasn't worth a shit in like 2013, 2014. Like original music was worth nothing almost. And thank God in a lot of ways for streaming, even though it doesn't pay the way recorded music used to pay, it's better than zero, I have to say. And you know, because piracy, you can't really stop it. I mean, good luck, but technology is always going to find a way around it. So if you can get people to pay $10 a month to have access to music, it's better than just getting it for free like they were going to do anyway, which is, you know, that's just my opinion. Sometimes it's an unpopular one, but I think the music industry has seen this amazing resurgence because of that. So now when I do deals with artists, I'm on the other side, it's very much around, instead of controlling the rights of the artists and signing away their master recordings and signing away their publishing, it's a more of a distribution model and a distribution deal, and label services on top of that. So, hey, we can help you distribute your music. We can put you in front of a large audience, and we can give you these resources, whether that's money or marketing or both, but you don't have to sign away your rights like you used to a major. And so I think artists have a lot more power now. They have a lot of more options. I mean, there's literally dozens and dozens of options in terms of who you can partner with and still stay independent. So I think it's fiercely different than it was. And for me, it's exciting. I find what I'm doing now is a lot more exciting than it was 15 years ago when I was touring and grinding.
We've reached the part of the show where I have to ask you, what is the worst gift you've ever been given?
You know, I thought about this before we got on here today. I've been given some pretty terrible gifts, but I actually think it's a gift that I gave somebody else, which was I thought it was funny, but it also turned out to be a very a very unfortunate and awkward moment. So a couple years ago, we were doing a Secret Santa. I don't know if you would know a Secret Santa. Christmas gift exchange at the company. And I bought the gift before I really knew who I was buying the gift for. It's Secret Santa. And it, you know, it turned out to be this guy who had a great sense of humor, but also is the kind of guy who's very awkward in certain situations. If you embarrass him, and I had bought a shake weight. You know what shake weights are?
No.
So anybody listening, check these things out. It's hilarious. It's called a shake weight on YouTube, but it's basically, it was supposed to be a workout tool where you shake this thing. It looks like a dumbbell, like a weight, but it ended up becoming an industry joke because people would hold it up in front of their face and shake it around, and ended up having this like completely phallic comedic thing to it. And it is just so absurd. And now it's, I guess it's a gag gift, but I found one at a store here and I got it for him. And he proceeded to, in front of the entire office and company, demonstrate the shake weight in front of all these people. And it was so embarrassing for me and everybody else. But I thought it was fantastic.
I'm just looking at some pictures now of shake weight. I now get it. I now get it.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Let's move a bit into what you are doing, because I know you're currently working in A&R for SoundCloud. So exactly, sort of day to day, what does that entail for you?
So historically, SoundCloud, most people know it as a streaming platform. We're the world's largest open source audio platform. And, you know, we've had a couple great moments in the company's history where we were known for things like SoundCloud Rap and breaking artists like Billie Eilish and Chance the Rapper. And a lot of people like that have gotten their start on the platform. That's what people really remember about SoundCloud. What's happening now is we have transitioned into more of a label services company that supports artists alongside them during their career. So as opposed to just, hey, once your song blows up on SoundCloud, then you go get signed to a major, we're now participating alongside of that and saying, hey, we can do distribution as well. We can take your music to Spotify and Apple Music and Tidal and YouTube, and we can help you on our own platform. So instead of leaving us, why don't you stay with us and we'll give you the resources to have a career. So that's really where the focus of my day-to-day is aligning SoundCloud with great artists, great producers, great managers and management companies, independent labels. And of course, we still work with the majors as well. I mean, they're all great partners. And so each one of those different facets brings something different to the table and a strength. And I think the way we've been able to pivot has been really smart, but also challenging. And that's what gives us the competitive advantage. We have a leg up, in my opinion. We are able to not only be a partner for these artists to all the other major platforms, but we ourselves are a platform with millions and millions of captive listeners and the data to support it. So, you know, to answer your question, I spend my time trying to find the best artists and the best partners that we can have participation with.
We mentioned quite a few of the different streaming platforms that are out there. I mean, Apple Music, Spotify, SoundCloud, Tidal, and then obviously you've got, you know, YouTube and TikTok doing their thing as well. What do you think, if something else comes into the market, what do you think is going to have to happen for them to try and blow everything out of the water?
It's safe to say that TikTok is the number one music discovery platform in the world at the moment, and they're not shy about saying that themselves, right? And a lot of that reason is because they're almost genre atheistic, right? There's no favorability. It's all based on who's sharing what, and anybody can upload anything. They can upload original sounds. They can use music that's already built into the app, that's been licensed. And then there's a visual component attached to it. So what you have all of a sudden is somebody dancing in their bedroom to a song you've never heard, but because you like what they're doing with the visual part, all of a sudden you're captured by the audio too, and you want to know what that song is. That doesn't really happen on any other platform. And so for somebody else to come into the space and really flip it on its head, I think they're going to have to make something really dangerous, very, very dangerous. It's going to basically have to corner the market in terms of before an artist even has a chance to be picked up by a label or an indie, it's going to have to create a net in which it grabs those artists and those songs and those content creators and nurtures them before it has a chance to make it to the wider marketplace. And if somebody creates that tool, which I think a lot of people are trying to create that tool, I think that could be a disruptor to a TikTok. And maybe they're trying to build it too. But to me, that's the only way to do it, right? How do you become a dangerous company?
Certainly in years gone by, there's been that sort of argument that an artist's image is as important, if not more important, than the voice itself in terms of being able to sell that person to the general public. Do you think that is still the case?
You know, I do not think so, because if you look at what's happening on TikTok and Instagram and these visual mediums, it doesn't really matter what somebody looks like so long as they're compelling as a person. I personally think that the most successful artists are the ones that are the most real. They're the most full of integrity. And it doesn't matter if they're good looking or if they're heinous, or it doesn't really matter so long as they own what they are and they live it and breathe it, because that's always going to find an audience. And I think genuineness is the key factor. If what you're doing audio and visual wise and the way you talk to your fans is totally genuine and the fans feel that, I want to work with you, because I'm a big believer in dropping the act, right? I just think like this whole idea that you need to come up with an image and you need to be this certain person when you're on stage and be a certain person when your fans are watching, that's bullshit. People want access. I mean, when people buy a ticket to go see Taylor Swift at the Staples Center or at Wembley Arena, okay, there's a good portion of that is because they want to hear the songs, but they can hear those songs anytime they want. Uh-huh. They can wake up in the morning and hear that song anytime they want. The reason they're going to spend 500 quid or whatever it is to go see Taylor Swift at Wembley Arena is because of the access. They want to be within X amount of feet of that person's presence because they feel like they connect with her. And because she's so good at being herself with her fans, and she opens her door to her life wide open. Like, she's always like telling her feelings and her personal problems and her fucking cats and what she feeds them. And it's like, so it's almost ridiculous, but that's what people want, is the access. And so to me, the days of signing an artist because they look so cool or they're so dope, which is an LA term, or whatever it might be, I think those days are over. I think TikTok and SoundCloud and Spotify, these platforms have leveled the playing field. And if you're willing to just kind of let it all go, you can have a career.
It brings me on nicely to my next question, which is around touring. Obviously, the COVID pandemic has changed live performance. I mean, it's completely stopped live performance for the best part of a year. Once we get back to a bit more normality, other than, you know, maybe a reduced crowd size, do you feel that touring and live performance is going to be somewhat different than it was before?
God, I hope not. You know, I'd be remiss if I said it's not going to change. It certainly will, but I don't know if it'll change forever. I think the world will change because of the pandemic. We're going to have widespread testing and vaccines and those sorts of things. And I know companies like Live Nation are talking about making people have a vaccination and or a negative COVID test to go to concerts. But eventually, this will be like anything else. This will be something that it just becomes part of everyday life. And we get back to being in an arena or a small club with 300 people sweating and spitting on each other and doing those things. But, you know, touring is so crucial to an artist's career because the music is basically the business card. The music is, hey, nice to meet you. I'm so-and-so artist. Here's my business card. And my website's on there, right? It's like, okay, I now know who you are. But the real moneymaker and the real connection is to show up, play those songs for those fans and connect with them and meet them after the show, sign the autographs, do the meet and greets. And without that, I think the music business is a void. I truly think it's a void. And people are hungry for that to come back in full force. I actually predict that when concerts do come back, it's going to be like, you know, Woodstock all over again. I think it's just going to be a fucking party left and right. People are going to be like, you know, no holds barred, just out there full force. So let's see, but that's my hope.
We mentioned a little bit earlier about the money in streaming not being, you know, as good as maybe the artists themselves would like it to be. Have you noticed the correlation between the prices of tickets for concerts going up as that streaming revenue goes down, as we were just saying about the moneymaker there being touring?
Yeah, I mean, there's a direct correlation. You've got to, as an artist or as a label, whoever you are that's in the middle, you've got to find a way to make up for that revenue somewhere. You know, thank God there's all these independent merch companies now too. I mean, I think artists have figured out that you can sit at home and you can do drop ship, made to order merchandising custom to your fans. So, you know, you can sell a hoodie on your website as an artist to, you might only have 100 diehard fans, but if 100 diehard fans buy a hoodie and a coffee mug for a $45 price tag, and it only cost you $15 to $18 to make, that paid your rent that month. Mm. And you don't necessarily have to tour to do that. But of course, there's a direct correlation from streaming revenue and download revenue paying less and less because of the saturation and the licensing fees, and that driving the ticket price up to make up for it on the other side. And don't forget, a lot of these artists are in debt to the labels a lot of time because they signed a 360 deal where they got some of that money up front, but they have to recoup it back later. So to recoup that money faster, they're giving the label a piece of their touring and their merchandise and their publishing. And so if they want to make that money back quicker and get another advance, they're going to drive the price up, or at least they think they should drive the price up to make that money back faster to reach that next step, next milestone. But there's definitely a direct correlation, but I think more and more we're seeing people realizing that you can be an independent artist and have all these different ways of doing things without having to sacrifice those types of situations. But I really don't know where the final solution is going to be in terms of what streaming turns out to be. I mean, James, I don't know if you have any insight there, but like where you think streaming might end up in the next 5 to 10 years is a mystery to everybody. But I think we all hope that it goes to a place where the revenue is more and more positive for the artist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Away from the music for a second, I wanted to touch on your own podcast, which is No Shortcuts. Tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, actually I have been prodded by most of my friends and industry friends and peers for years to do a podcast. I think I finally just broke during lockdowns and decided to do it. The podcast is called No Shortcuts, and the premise is interviewing industry people, artists, managers, anybody who's in this industry, and dispelling the myth of overnight success. I think everybody's got a story, whether you're a 13-year-old influencer on TikTok that all of a sudden has a billion views, or you know, you're an artist who's been touring for 35 years. Both of those people are going to have a story that is surprising. You know, if you're that 13-year-old, you've probably been taking dancing lessons or learning how to sing or trying to do this, or you've probably put up 50 videos before that didn't work. And then when you realize you got a billion views on your TikTok, that's not a career. That's the beginning of something, and you're got to be in it for the long haul. And so I think it's inspiring to hear stories from people of all walks of life in this business to tell those stories, because there's just no shortcut to success or having a sustainable career. Every single person I know will tell you, you got to be in it for the long run. And if you're not, get out now, because there is no guarantees, and you got to do it for the love of the game, and you got to be able to just roll with the punches. But the podcast is going great. I think I'm 5 or 6 episodes in, and I'm booked out for 3 or 4 months solid. And some of the guests are really, really great to talk to. So yeah, it's going great.
Edgel, wrapping up, if you could go right back to the beginning of your career and buy yourself a gift to help to get where you are now, what gift would you give yourself?
If I could buy myself a gift. Wow. Wasn't prepared for that. If I could buy myself a gift, I honestly probably would have bought myself a really nice camera to document more things. I wish I had video footage of about 15 years where I just have the memories in my head. And there are some things documented by fans and friends, but if I could go back and just be diligent about documenting things, I think it would be a nice camera.
And finally, where can people find out more about you and what you do?
I think the best place is on my podcast website. So it's noshortcutspodcast.com. And you can also find me on Instagram under my name, Edgel Groves Jr.
Fantastic. Well, Edgel, thanks so much for joining the show. It's been great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks, James. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast service to make sure you never miss another episode. You can find us on both Twitter and Instagram at Bad Gifts Pod, as well as online at badgiftspod.com.